about Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Ted Burke, and he'll be answering your most important questions on Dorado on a Fly. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Ted a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box there to send your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Ted Burke about Dorado on a Fly. Front Range Anglers, a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 31 years and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about this premier shop by logging on to their website at www.frontrangeanglers.com. That's www.frontrangeanglers.com. Well, before we introduce Tad, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we're giving away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So you have two chances to win tonight for a drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for the link under Tad's section that says, click here to register for the drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a $25 gift certificate for Front Range Anglers in Boulder, Colorado, which you can redeem either in their store or online in their online store. So here's how you can win that gift certificate. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. And the question will be about something we talked about during the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and location using the text box on our homepage. So listen closely, use the best typing skills, and maybe you'll win that $25 gift certificate. Our guest tonight is Tad Burke. Tad has been a full-time fly fishing guide working in South Florida and the Florida Keys since 1986. Tad's specialty is hunting down trophy tarpon and bonefish, has guided his fly fishing clients 38 top 10 finishes in invitational fly championships, with seven of these being first place finishes. He appeared in periodicals including the Florida Sportsman, Fly Fishing and Saltwater, Polo Magazine, Center Console Magazine, NPCA Publications, National Park Publications, Miami Herald, Palm Beach Post, Key West Citizen, Isla Mirada Free Press, and the Isla Mirada Reporter. Tad has contributed greatly to the sport of fly fishing and the fisheries he works in as directors and members of the organizations such as Commodore Florida Keys Fly Fishing Guides Association, the Don Holly Foundation, Bonefish and Tarpon Unlimited, Coalition of Park Users, the Nearshore Waters of Isla Mirada, Combined Structure and Operating Plan for Everglades National Park, and the Seagrass Outreach Partnership. And even though Tad spends much of his time contributing to many of these great organizations, he spends the majority of his time on the water learning more about tarpon, bonefish, dorado, and hunting them down. Tad, welcome back to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Hey, Roger, what's shaking? Thanks for the opportunity.
Sure, sure. Good to have you back on board here. So what have you been fishing for lately down there?
Well, you know, we're just coming out of our tarpon season, but also it does coincide with our dolphin season as well.
Uh-huh.
So on the days that I have not been in the backcountry chasing tarpon, I have got out a few days, and the dolphin fishing, we've had some decent weather and good weed lines, so there's been some fish out there to be caught and been having a good time. It's a great species and very fast-growing, highly migratory, can be found all over the place. So it's always good to see them this time of year and keeps us active.
So we're, you know, we're talking dolphin, dorado, mahi-mahi, all the same fish, right?
Correct.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of people, I think, get confused when dolphin's used because they think of flipper, and it's not the case. But in Florida, it's called dolphin, and primarily, is that the term used in Florida?
You know, I think that that small communication problem with people who aren't real familiar with the fish is why they started using mahi-mahi, which is Hawaiian for strong, and Dorado. I mean, it goes by a lot of different names, but it was just to kind of eliminate any confusion to let people know that they actually weren't eating a mammal, rather they were eating a fish.
Yeah. So you said they are migratory, but so are they just moving through the Keys at this point, or are they always available in the Keys in some way, shape, or form?
No, they're not always available. There's times of year that they do show up. I have seen them every month of the year, but the predictable months is more in the summertime. A lot of bird life, a lot of seagrass floating, sargasso, weed, and stuff out in the Gulf Stream and even closer into our reef. Everything's relatively close here. There are days when we have to run 25 to 30 miles offshore to find weed lines and current rips, but a lot of days, you know, it's 12 to 15 miles offshore. They are highly migratory. They do travel pretty much all the tropical and subtropical oceans and seas around the world. So they're very widely dispersed species.
So are they moving primarily north now to get into cooler water, or south, or what's their direction? Where are they trying to go?
Well, they're actually following schools of bait. They're following weeds. They're moving to where the food moves. And most of the time, they're not necessarily predictable as to which direction they're going. They tend to hang around debris, and they tend to travel weed lines and current rips. And you can find them on calm days. They may be swimming on the surface, and you can actually see them creating a little bit of a head wake. And on some days, they may be down below the surface under weed lines up to 50 or 100 feet down below a line of weed, so you won't even see them. And the trick is, you know, if you're going to catch them on fly, and even if you're going to catch them on spin or bait, but mainly if you're going to catch them on fly, is how to get them interested in what you're doing and get them fired up so they want to eat.
Okay. Now, how big do these fish get, and how fast do they grow?
Well, the world records and the species records are up in the 80 pounds, 70 pounds, but that is a very, very rare fish. This fish basically lives, its lifespan is around 5 years. They maybe make it to 4 years. They grow incredibly fast. They eat everything in their way. If it moves and tries to get away from them, they eat it. They're highly carnivorous. They'll eat smaller dolphin. So whatever's in their way, they will eat. But an average fish in early part of the season, which early part of the season here would be May, would be late May, mid-May. They would really start kind of showing up around a little more prevalent. The water's warming up. That fish would probably average anywhere from 12 to 15 pounds. And there's days when you'd see many fish in the 20 to 30-pound range. And then I think there's bodies of fish that move. So as you kind of go into July and June and July and August, your average may get smaller, sometimes much smaller. And then you'll find a few big fish thrown in here or there.
Mm-hmm.
Florida does have some relatively liberal bag limits as far as quantity and size limit. So they are high, they're harvested a lot. People go out and dolphin fish, and they kill a lot of them. So
they are tasty. Yeah.
Yes, they are, very much so. Fortunately, they do grow fast, and there seems to be plenty of them.
Mm-hmm.
As far as stock assessments, because they travel in international boundaries and they're really pursued all over, from people hand-lining in Cuba and Venezuela to big offshore boats chasing them in the Pacific coast and, you know, here in the Keys. So as far as a stock assessment, I'm not sure. I haven't been able to find anything that they really have a good idea of as far as how the stock is doing. But every year they seem to show up in numbers, so I don't think it's a fish that's actually being overfished.
So, but they are fished commercially down in the Keys as well?
They're fished commercially around the world.
Yeah. Okay.
Hand-lined, hook and line, mostly fishing, but they are sold at market.
Mm-hmm. So you don't see the fishing, whether it's commercial or sport fishermen, that having much pressure on them or effect at this point, then? They're pretty healthy as far as you know.
I would think it seems to be relatively healthy. Like I say, early in the year, the fish tend to be a little larger when they start showing up. And I think these fish move in large bodies of fish and then break out maybe into smaller bodies when they get into areas where there actually is a lot of food. And I don't know if they've done any tagging on them. So I know, for instance, just for tarpon, they tagged a tarpon in Boca Grande Pass, and 44 hours later it was in the Mississippi River, and 36 hours later it was back at Boca Grande Pass. because that's an inshore species, mm-hmm. and dolphin are highly migratory species with the Gulf Stream, with, you know, massive oceans to move them around. Who's to say whether these fish, you know, they show up one day and they're here for a week and then they're gone, and we're looking around for them, and there's a few small ones here or there. Who knows where they went? They could have gone, you know, anywhere. They could be up to, all the way up past the Carolinas on the coast. They could be over towards the other side of the Bahamas on the Atlantic side. There's just no telling. So they, as part of stock assessments and where they go, I don't think really anyone really knows. I just think they're everywhere in subtropical and tropical regions.
Yeah. Now, do they, you said earlier, I think you said sometimes you may have to go out 15 miles or so, but are they primarily following the coastline? Or you're not going to find them particularly out at sea, I mean, in deep water?
They don't necessarily follow the coastline. They they follow more current rips, the Gulf Stream. You know, they're living out in the open ocean. They want to use as least amount of energy to travel the greatest distance or area that they, till they find food, and then they'll stay in an area until the food resources, you know, pretty much depleted, and then they'll just truck it on to wherever they can find some more food. These things are highly carnivorous, and with a lifespan, if you think about the records that are in the 70 to 80 pounds, you catch a 30 or 40 pound fish, that fish has only been alive for 4 years, five years, so you think about how fast that fish has to grow. So all of a sudden, when you start putting that together, that fish has got to eat a lot of food.
Yeah.
He's got to
be
eating pretty much 24/7 in order for him to grow that fast. As
well,
there's a lot of things in the ocean that actually eat dolphin. Wahoo, marlin, sharks. So they're prolific in the fact that they are also a food source for larger predators on the food chain as well as humans.
Yeah. Ocean is a vicious place, isn't it?
Everything's got to eat, Roger.
Yeah, everybody's eating each other out there. Oh, gosh. Yeah, yeah, it's kind of a stressful way to run your life, right, isn't it? Always waking up in the morning and wondering if you're going to get eaten that day, but that's basically what happens.
So, you know, you got 4 years to eat and reproduce.
And that's your job, right? Yeah.
4 or 5 years, eat and reproduce, make as many as you can.
Yeah,
you know.
And move on, yeah. Okay, well, let's, Roy Fukushima in Orange, California, was asked about weight, rods, fly line, type leader, tippet size, basically how you rigging up to go after dolphin. And, is it, you know, maybe you can compare it to tarpon and bonefish as well as you know, the same kind of
gear. Whenever I'm focusing on any offshore species, I like to keep several rods rigged. You just never know what's going to show up. For dolphin fishing, I tend to stick with 10 weights. I'll have some smaller rods because, really, you want to match the rod to the size of the fish. You definitely don't want to be throwing a 10 or a 12 weight if your fish are 5 or 7 pounds on a weed line that you found. You can drop down to a 9 weight because you want to enjoy catching them. You don't want to be over-rod. But in the event that you're on a weed line or a floating piece of debris and a 30 or 40 pounder shows up, you don't want to be undergunned either. So whenever I leave to go offshore, folk targeting any kind of pelagic species with a fly rod, I like to have several rods rigged. I might have everything from a 6-weight all the way up to a 12-weight rig. Some of the other species you might run into out there, you just never know. They could be triple tail floating around some of the debris, small Almaco jacks. There's things that you could find that could keep you busy until the dolphins show up, because you could be sitting on a patch of weed or a piece of debris and not really seeing a whole lot of activity, and all of a sudden dolphin will show up on it. So 10 weight as a norm to have ready pretty much all the time. 9 weight's a great rod to have as well. And then I'll always have something smaller, but that's a good average. Floating lines are best.
So you don't have to go deep? Are you there?
No. Yes, sir. No,
okay.
No, these fish are, when you're dolphin fishing on a fly rod, it's all sight fishing. These fish are on the surface, they're under weeds, they're zipping around a piece of debris. You're seeing the fish, so yes, floating fly lines work just fine.
Okay, and what do you use for leader and tippet? Do you need shock tippet? How do you rig up?
Generally, I rig everything IGFA legal. In the event that I'm just looking to catch fish and I'm fishing, you can go like straight 20-pound. Straight 15-pound. If you go below 15-pound on your class tippet, I would definitely put a small piece of shock on there, around 30 pounds. They do have rough mouths, and you never know when that trophy fish is going to show up. So it's good to, if anything under 15 pounds, I would definitely put on a shock tippet. And you could argue that you would definitely want a 30 to 40-pound shock tippet on everything, even up to 16 and 20-pound test. So it's really a matter of preference. Usually when you find a school of dolphin or you find dolphin on something, they're cookie cutter, where they're all pretty much the same size. So you might have one that's a little bigger, and you could always have a big bull or a big cow come into that school of fish, but the majority of the time you find the school of fish, they're all cookie cutter size, and you have time when you find them. It's not like you're sight fishing and they're going to run by you and disappear. Usually if they're around a piece of debris, they're going to stick around. So from a distance, you can approach that, take a good look at see if they're there. And if you see them, you can say, well, you know, those are fish I can easily catch on my 9-weight. Or, wow, there's some good sizing in there. I want to go ahead and make sure I have a 10-weight.
Mm-hmm. And we can come back to the strategy of how to fish for them here in a minute. But the what about backing? Are these, do these fish run? Do they rip off your backing?
They definitely do, depending on the size, but they definitely run and they definitely jump. There's nothing really special that you have to do. Any of your standard large arbor reels usually hold between 200 and 300 yards of backing. That's always been plenty for everything that I've encountered. If you were to hook a really large fish, I'm sure you'd have to chase them down, or you'd have to leave whatever you were on and get after them. But most of your reels carry plenty of backing. In the event that you were somewhere off of Panama or Nicaragua or off the coast of in the Pacific somewhere, and you actually ran into really big fish, normally you're fishing 12 and 14 weight rods over there for billfish and sailfish and marlin. So you would have anywhere from 500 to 600 yards of backing on those reels. Personally, I haven't seen any fish that you would need any more than your regular 300 yards of backing on your size 12-weight rod or reel.
So same basic rig you're using for your tarpon.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you said Dorado basically eat anything that's moving in front of them. So Joe asked, Houston, Texas, also Tim in Illinois, want to know about what flies work well for Dorado and what size hooks. Can you kind of tell us about some of the flies you use?
Absolutely. There's a real misconception that big fish and pelagic fish, they all want to eat something big. Mm-hmm. But it's been my experience that these fish that are moving around weed lines and debris, they're eating very small things, sometimes things that are half an inch long. It's a lot that a predator runs into a lot more smaller things to eat than he does big things, and also he expends a lot less energy. So using smaller flies, I tend to like the Pugliese fiber just personally. It dries out quickly in the air. It's a relatively sparse fly that gives off a good silhouette when it's in the water. Any kind of bait fish pattern will work. Now, dolphin can be extremely finicky. They can follow flies. They can get to where they won't eat anything. They can be extremely frustrating. The water's clear. They're not necessarily leader shy because they won't eat anything sometimes, even a chunk of bait. So if you're in an area where you're fishing live baits or you have live baits to pitch on the water or they're around an area where there's a lot of bait, and you'll go by a weed patch and you'll see small fish swimming around. If they're eating on that, any kind of bait fish pattern would work. Now, if you're throwing chunks, if your mate or your captain or your mate on the boat has chunked up a bunch of ballyhoo into little half-inch chunks and you're throwing chunks of bait out and they're eating chunks, then you could use, like, any kind of bunny strip, white bunny strip or a clump of white feathers, something that would really look like more a shiny chunk of bait that you wouldn't strip, that wouldn't be like a traditional stripped fly. So it really all depends on the situation. So that's another reason it's good to have a few rods rigged. If you get to an area and you see some dolphin and you can't get them interested in anything and you start cutting up some ballyhoo or some any kind of menhaden and cutting them in pieces and throwing chunks out and you notice that they start eating chunks, probably not going to respond well to a fly that you throw in the water that looks like the bait fish that you're stripping. However, they might respond really well to a fly that you throw out into the water and just let dead drift as if it were a chunk.
Kind of like a flesh fly from Alaska where it's simulating salmon flesh,
sure.
I guess. Yeah, kind of thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're going to catch them, there's sure, everybody wants to catch them in his clamor, stripping a big bait fish pattern, but sometimes if they're not eating that and you want to catch fish, you have to be able to adapt to what they want to do because they don't always eat. They can be very frustrating at times.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we experience that everywhere on the water, right? Even with trout fishing, you know. You'd love to catch them on a dry fly, but sometimes you have to throw out a San Juan worm, you know. And that's just the way it is. Well, Ted, we need to take a quick break here, but so hold on here, and we'll be right back, and then we'll talk more about fishing for Dorado. Thanks. Captain Bob Jaspers of Flats Time Charters will introduce you to the Mosquito Lagoon, Indian River, and No Motor Zone of the Banana River on the east coast of Central Florida. Only a short drive from Orlando, you will sight fish for big redfish, spotted sea trout, and black drum, as well as the seasonal snook and tarpon. Captain Bob is a lifetime resident of the area, and it shows in his knowledge of the local fish, flora, and fauna. Call Flats Time Charters now and arrange your next memorable adventure. You can reach Captain Bob at 321-631-4051. That's 321-631-4051. Or go to his website at www.flatstime.com. That's FLATSTIME.com. Flatstime.com. If you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, we're talking with Tad Burke about Dorado on a Fly. If you'd like to ask Tad a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. So, Tad, I always ask my guests, you know, at this point in the show, what's happening in your fly fishing world. So tell us a little bit about what you do down there, and if you're working on any of these special projects right now, we'd love to hear about it.
Actually, I am doing some working on one project. The Florida Keys National Marine Sanctuary is in its rezoning process. So we are looking at rezoning, working on some rezoning of the Keys, protection of habitat, resources, and kind of looking at some fisheries issues as well. Ecologically, we're around the world. I think we're suffering from ocean acidification and rising water temperatures and things that are outside of the scope of human involvement, but they are happening. And I think the rezoning and some of the things that the scientists are thinking is how can we best go about protecting some of the resources with the knowledge and science that we do have against things that are unforeseen. There's some great things that are happening in the way of coral regrowth. The coral restoration has really progressed in the last 10 years or so. It's really amazing. They're actually growing more coral than they can plant. And as coral species around the world are becoming endangered, it's good to know that they can actually grow these things in a controlled environment and go out and plant them, and they're actually doing well. And that really is the basis of the water clarity and all the food chain. You know, that's kind of where it starts. And as of course the Everglades, we're still working on. There's constantly Everglades projects going on and funding and battling and trying to get water restored to Florida Bay. That's pretty much been ongoing for the last 20 years. They've been working on a project to raise the Tamiami Trail and get some fresh water flow in. So every estuary, even over in Louisiana estuary and the Gulf Coast, they're rebuilding some of the barrier islands. I mean, it's definitely on the radar for the environmentalist and ecologist, and also just for hurricane protection along the coast.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if it was the most recent National Geographic, but one of the recent issues, they were talking about mangroves moving north, and the mangrove forests have moved quite significantly north in Florida. And, you know, they're attributing that to the warming water.
I didn't read that one. I know in this edition there was in this National Geographic edition there was an article on Goliath grouper. So that was very interesting. And they seem to be doing well and recovering, but still they don't have a lot of science on them. And you know, the things once grew to 800 pounds. So,
yeah.
It's a big fish.
Yeah, I thought the mangrove thing was interesting because so many fish live in and around the mangroves and depend on the mangroves in Florida, right? I mean, that's
absolutely, as well as hurricane protection. All of the species from shrimp to tarpon, snook, your pelagic fishes like your sailfish, your marlin, your dolphin, they really don't grow up in estuary systems, but the estuaries are definitely important for all the other species.
Sure, yeah, the bait fish and so forth. And,
absolutely.
Yeah, so it'll be interesting how that changes Florida when there's more mangroves than there was before. You know, it's got to do some kind of change down there anyway, yeah. Well, tell us, if you do run a guide service down there, tell us what you guide for and, you know, how people can get a hold of you if they'd like to use your service.
You know, I have a couple boats. I pretty much accommodate all kinds of fishing, from the fly fisherman to the family that wants to go out and watch their kid catch their first fish. It's Florida's a great spot to visit. The Keys are, you know, Keys have things to offer that only where you can stay in the United States and actually really be in a tropical kind of environment. We have more species here, I think. One day you can be in the Everglades fishing for snook. The next day you can be on the reef catching mangroves and groupers and yellowtail snapper, and the next day you can be offshore chasing blue marlin and mahi, and you could even do that in one day if you wanted to.
Wonderful place. Yeah, the Keys are a wonderful
place.
And so how can people reach you? Do you have a website or a phone number that they can reach out?
My website, if they were just Google my name, Captain Tad Burke, they would eventually find me.
Okay. And they can get a hold of you through your website then?
And actually, they can get a hold of me through you.
Yeah.
Ask about flyfishing.com. You guys got my info right there.
Yeah. Okay. So, all right. Well, let's move on and talk more about the Dorado. And one other question.
We actually kind of dropped off on hook size, and I was going to.
Yeah, that's what I was just going to say. Yep.
Answer the gentleman's question. I fish everything from a 1/0. Just a standard 1/0 hook to up to a 3/0 hook, depending on the size fly that I'm using. And I found that the finickier the fish are, the harder they are to get to eat, the smaller fly I'll use.
Mm-hmm. There was another question kind of around that on any particular kind of hooks you like better than others?
I don't think it's really that important. All of your hooks nowadays are really premium, all your chemically sharpened hooks. And it's not like they're really hook or leader shy. I've caught them on everything from little bitty small single sidewash 1/0 hooks to, 3/0 hooks. So I don't think the choice of your hook is as important as just figuring out a way to get them fired up where they want to eat, because sometimes you'll see hundreds of them around the boat and they're just not interested in anything you have going on.
Okay. Regarding tying saltwater flies, any tips you can give on tying saltwater flies and any book recommendations, you know, where you can get fly patterns and learn how to tie them?
Roger, I would rather be hit in the head than tie flies.
Oh, okay.
I'm terrible at it. It's something that's never intrigued me. I will go. I have a young man who ties for me, and I will go sit down with him and show him exactly what I want and modify it with him until I get what and have somebody else tie him. But I never had an aptitude for it. And I have great respect for the people that do, because it is truly an art. It just was something that I never could pick up.
Yeah,
but I know
that
if you go online and if you were to Google, like, how to tie a dolphin fly or how to tie a mahi fly, I'm sure that you could find hundreds of YouTube videos on how to tie flies, tie a fly that you were looking for. And I know that Puglisi has some great on how to tie the bait fish patterns. He has some very detailed, you have to become a member of his buying club there, I think, but he has great videos to access. It's worth it. He shows you how to tie them with the Gracie fur. And really, they're just a good all-around bait fish pattern. You could take the same fly that you caught a dolphin with. You could go catch a mangrove snapper with. You could go catch a speckled trout with. You could go feed a tarpon with.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We do have some questions coming in on the Internet. One, I'm not sure if this is from somebody you know. Do you know a Megan?
I do know Megan. Good evening, Megan.
Her question is, Ted, have you ever run aground?
Yes, yes, I have. We're on the ground. There's any time you spend as much time on the water as I have, you're eventually going to hit something.
She must have personal experience with that. Huh? I'm sure there's an inside joke probably, here somewhere.
She probably has pushed my boat off at some time.
Leave it at that. Okay, well, we had to... You know she's listening anyway now. So.
Absolutely.
It's
good to have a fan.
Yeah, there you go. Treg Owings in Moscow, Idaho, asks, he says, my experience in Loretto, I believe he's talking over in the Baja side, if you throw dead chunk bait, it sinks and the Dorado follow them deep. Have you seen this, or how do you deal with that problem? Or is it a problem?
I've not seen that. If they were following the baits deep, you could definitely wrap a little bit of lead onto the front of your fly. I like to bring with me a little spool of, it's real small pencil lead. I know they use it for tying flies to wrap around the shank of the hook. You can weight your fly a little bit that way on a floating line. And if the first thing I would do is if that's something that's commonly happened where you go, I would definitely get a sink tip or a full-on sinking line to have on hand.
Treg also asked about what knots you use in your leaders. Any particular ones?
I tend to stay with just blood knots or improved blood knots. They go through the guides really easy. They go through the water really well.
Okay. From the shock tippet to the leader to the – okay.
Yes, sir. And uni knots to the hook or just Rhodes loop knots.
Right.
Just simple fishing knots.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have to be – very complex or complicated.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Another question from Julio in Odessa. It says, how does weather, tides, and time of day affect the Dorado fishing?
Actually, more so than the tides is the wind direction. Speaking solely for here, when we have winds that are coming out of the southeast and the south, it tends to blow a lot of weed inshore and blows it up against current rips, which causes it to actually congregate and make mats of weed, where you'll find areas where the weed is broken. We get a certain wind direction. It'll kind of congregate that weed and collect it in areas, and that larger body mass of weed tends to really help. I think as far as conditions, a little bit of chop on the water is always good, and if it's too rough, you really don't want to be out there. Unless you're in, a large vessel, and still it's not very comfortable. It's hard to cast in the boats jumping around and moving around. So we're far enough out offshore. These fish are in the Gulf Stream and out in deeper water. So really the tides don't affect them as much as it does is just finding where those current rips are and finding either birds that are working in area or debris.
Mm-hmm. Okay. When do you decide too rough to go out? Is there a certain...
I think that's a personal, very personal thing. Some people are fair weather and some people are hardcore.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really how you feel and how comfortable you are in big conditions, or it's really, it varies with each individual.
But don't you personally have a point where you just say, no, it's not going to happen today?
Yes, absolutely. When it gets to 20 plus miles an hour, I'd rather do something else.
Yeah. Time to go have a beer, huh?
Well, there's other, you can go chase other species, you can fish in.
Maybe go the other side of the Keys or whatever. And
Absolutely. That's one of the joys of living in the Florida Keys is we're very seldom are we actually shut out of doing anything because we have shallow water and deep water relatively close access. So we can usually always come up with a plan.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Dean Wormel wrote in. He's from Westford, Massachusetts, and he's asking about, are there any decent shore wading fishing opportunities for Dorado? Is it all from a boat?
I have never heard of anywhere that you could actually fish for them from shore. They're deep water to 200 feet of water. I guess if you were on an oil platform in the Gulf, you might have an opportunity to see some come by or hanging around the platform, but if you hooked at one, I don't even know what you would do. They'd jump and run and probably be all wrapped up underneath the legs of the oil rig, and they'd be kind of done with it. So boats are pretty much the only way to access them as far as I know.
Okay. Now, do you find Dorado on the Gulf side as well? Are they all around Florida or primarily on the East Coast?
In the Gulf of Mexico, out more into the Gulf, like the central part of the Gulf of Mexico, off the coast of Louisiana, Alabama, Texas, when they get far offshore, absolutely. These fish live in the, they're out in the Gulf Stream and out in the middle part of the Gulf. You don't really find them so much in shallow water. Very seldom. Here in the Keys, we kind of have an interesting situation where the reef drops off relatively fast, so you can go from 30 feet of water to 120 feet of water within a short amount of distance. So there are times when I have seen dolphin chasing and shallowing bait up in 30 and 40 feet of water, but they don't stay up there very long. They turn around and zip right back off into the deep water. But they have, I have seen them in shallow water, but it's rare. It's not like something that you would see every day.
Okay, time to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk more about strategies and tactics and trips down to the Keys. Keeney's Fly Shop in Sacramento, California features classes on all aspects of fly fishing. They have an extensive inventory and fly tying department and a friendly, experienced staff whose primary goal is your complete satisfaction. Among their many services, one can book private waters or take advantage of their international travel service. Visit their extensive website at www.keeney.com. That's www.keeney.com, K-I-E-N-E. Or you can call them at 1-800-400-0359. That's 1-800-400-0359. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Tad Burke about Dorado on the Fly. If you'd like to ask Tad a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. Receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, a couple of questions. Roy from Orange, California wanted to know techniques you use in Florida apply to the Pacific side in Baja for Dorado?
I have not fished for Dorado in Baja. I have seen them and fished for them in Costa Rica and done Guatemala. I would say that the things you would be looking for over there are relatively the same as you would here. Any kind of debris in the water could have been around. Birds work in an area. All those things are schools of bait. I think you could find those in all the same, you know, you'd really be looking for the same kind of conditions. Current risk, any kind of debris.
Yeah, so when you go out there, you know, for a day looking for Dorado, you head out to where you know the Gulf Stream is primarily at and just, you know, trying to spot, like you said, birds or debris floating, and you just run
when
it
I'm,
until you find that?
Exactly. When I'm going dolphin fishing, I run out usually anywhere from, I let the conditions tell me. If I'm seeing a lot of weed, I'll start looking hard. If I haven't run into any weed or current rips, I'll keep running until I do. The trick is to find, and that it varies every day. One day they may be 15 miles out, the next day they may be 25. So if they may be in 300 feet of water, and they may be in 800 feet of water. So really it's just moving until you find an area or a situation where there's current, where there's debris, where there's birds. Whenever you start putting all those things together, you're going to find them in the summertime. They're going to be somewhere close by.
Okay. And you said earlier it's primarily a sight fishing activity for Dorado. One question was, you know, how fast and accurate must your cast be? I know from fishing for tarpon, you got to be on your game because they're coming at you and they're going to be gone in a second. So, you know, compare it to tarpon and how much different it is from tarpon fishing.
Very different. Very, very different. These fish aren't really, they're kind of hanging around an area. If you find them and your fly hits the water and it starts moving, they're going to see it. If they don't see it, cast over by them again. They'll eventually see it moving and chase it, and if they don't, you need to start throwing chunks or get them. So that's what I'm saying, some way to get them fired up so that they want to eat. So the accuracy of your casting is not that important, not as important as some other species where you need to put it in a coffee cup. It can pretty much be in a, you know, in the general vicinity, you know, the size of your dining room table. They're going to find it.
Mm-hmm. So they'll come and chase the
bait.
Whereas tarpon, you're trying to lead the fish and trying not to disrupt the pod and so forth. You don't have any of those kind of issues here. Right?
Totally different game.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Now, you said, you know, you put out some bait or chum to bring the fish. That's kind of your last resort kind of situation. Otherwise, there's no need to really chum them or anything to get them going?
No, not at all. It's, if you find it, if you pull up to a weed line or you pull up to a piece of debris and you see them around, you can cast out, and if one of them jumps on and you get hooked up, then they'll, as you go on, they'll get a little smarter. So it's always good to have a few chunks, or if you've gotten some live baits on the way out, throw a handful of live baits. And that's another way to get them up to, if you come to a big weed patch and you're not seeing them around, to kind of ease off it a ways and throw a few live baits in. Maybe even put a live bait on a spinning rod on a hook and just kind of slow troll it around. They're schooling fish, so if you catch one, chances are there's a bunch more there, and they usually all just come at once. It could be anywhere from 10 to 70.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But, that, you know, it's all about locating them, because once you locate them, then you're usually good to go.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you pull up to these weed beds or the, you know, whatever floating structures of any kind, are they pretty easy to see in the water?
Yes, you'll see them. They're very bright. They're beautiful fish, a lot of color. You'll definitely see them.
Usually how deep, would you say, within the top 15 feet of water or so?
There's no real general rule. Like I say, they could be 25 feet down, which you wouldn't see them.
Yeah.
And then there's some techniques that you can get to do to kind of try to draw them to the surface. Slow trolling live baits is one. Throwing some live baits in the water, throwing some chunks in the water, trying to get their attention. But the majority of the time, they could be anywhere from 5 to 8, 10 feet below the surface, 2 feet below the surface. And when you pull up, you'll see them. They move around. You'll be able to see them swimming in the water.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, is there any, you had mentioned before, you can use kind of a general presentation approach. So there's nothing specific in your presentation. Just throw it in the general direction and
get it moving.
Get it moving.
And also, too, you know, this is about learning people that want to go out and do this. This is about them studying and learning the behavior of fish. Mm-hmm. So if you're stripping the fly really fast, they're chasing it but not paying that much of attention to it, you might strip it slower. You might throw it out and let it dead drift. Trying to figure out what the fish wants, how it wants, you know, if it's going to feed, if it wants a smaller bait. Like I say, when I get turned down by a fish right away, I just go to a smaller fly.
Okay.
So I'll have several rods rigged, and they won't all have the same fly on there. They'll have the fly that I'm hoping that they're going to eat, and then I'll have the next smallest size down fly or even two sizes smaller down on my next rod. Learning, you know, watching the fish's behavior. Did that fish light up and get all colored up like he wanted to eat? Did he kind of follow it a minute and totally turn off and ignore it? Then you have to start thinking, you know, this is just like any other kind of fishing, whether you're trout fishing or tarpon fishing or, you know, fishing for Atlantic salmon, trying to figure out exactly what that fish wants and how's the best way to present your fly, and just watching the body language and the behavior of the fish will tell you that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, fishing's a good excuse to be outside, and fishing's really about learning about the fish that you're pursuing, learning to read their body language, their behavior. You know, the more knowledgeable you get, the more time you spend doing it, the better you get at quickly figuring out how to catch them, whether it's for a release or whether it's for your cooler.
Right. Treg in Idaho also just wrote in on the Internet. He wanted to know if keeping a fish in the water attracts other fish. I mean, I don't know if he's after, like, the schooling idea.
Absolutely.
Oh, okay.
Absolutely. Yep, great question. It absolutely keeps them around. They'll stay together, whereas sometimes releasing a fish, if you have a fish and you don't have another fish on the rod and you release that fish and he takes off, a lot of the times the school will go with that fish and sound.
Hmm.
So it's a great question. It's always good to keep one on a hook. It's good to have a spinning rod with you. You can throw a jig out, throw a bait out, hook a fish, and do fish for a while and catch a few more and then take them off and hook another one. And it's always keep one on the line if you're looking to catch a few.
Interesting. I never heard that technique. Oh, that's cool. Craig's also, he's just on a roll here with questions. He wants to know, have you ever changed tippet size to turn them on? Does that have an effect?
I have not changed tippet size. Usually I'm fishing pretty small stuff. One of the things you do need to think about is if you do start dropping down in tippets, say you go down to 8 pound or you go down to 6 pound, one of the techniques when you're fishing lighter tippets, especially with a fish that could possibly sound in the deep water and you're not casting very far, is to cut your fly line in half. So measure from the head of your fly line down and keep it around 50 feet long. So you're actually taking almost 50 feet of fly line off, which is a lot of resistance in the water. So if you hook a good fish and he dives down to 150 feet or 100 feet and then he decides he's going to bolt back to the surface, he's not dragging that extra feet of fly line around. And like I say, you don't have to cast far. This isn't about distance. These things will eat 10 feet from the boat. So if you're going to drop down and retip it, you might want to have a rod with a fly line.
So they're not skittish from you in the boat?
No, they get underneath the boat, swim right up to it, not at all.
They think you're just more structure, huh?
You're just more structure, but then again, sometimes they'll do that, but they will not eat anything that you have to offer them. So,
yeah.
You know, they don't get big by being stupid sometimes, and they get smart quick. If you start weeding out and you start catching some of their buddies and they're disappearing, they can, they catch on.
Yeah. Anything particular about hook setting methods that you use? Once you hook up, what do you do?
With all saltwater fly fishing, as I tell my clients, is just strip until you come tight.
Mm-hmm.
No, you know, if the hook's going in when it comes tight, it's either going to go in, be in a spot in his mouth where he goes in, or it's not.
Okay.
If you get him on the reel and you want to hit him with the rod a couple times, I think you can. It doesn't hurt anything. But I think on that first initial contact, when you come tight, that hook's either going in that fish or it's not.
Okay. And what's the fight like for the Dorado?
They're very acrobatic. Depending on their size, they can really scream off some line. They do jump a lot. Big fish will sound, too, so they'll go straight down where you're pulling straight up and down on them. And I don't know what a general rule would be per pound per minute, but they'll definitely test your drags and, you know, you catch a decent-sized fish, they'll give you a good spin.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
They're a lot of fun to catch. They're very beautiful. They're very acrobatic. They spend a lot of time in the air.
And they make good pictures.
They do. They change colors very quickly, though, once you get them out of the water. So if you're going to take a picture of them, do it as quick
as
you can.
Huh?
They'll start, once they start to dime, they lose a lot of color.
Okay. What about other fish that you find out? You know, like you said, well, if you're not finding Dorado, you might run into something else out there while you're looking for Dorado and, you know, to keep busy, a fish for something else. What else should you be prepared for to hook into out there?
Well, it's a really good question. And one, from my experience, when I'm actually going to be offshore in an area where there's dolphin and we're looking for dolphin, I always have a larger rod rigged with a really big fly in case a billfish shows up, whether it's a sailfish or a blue marlin or a white marlin. And that's pretty much anywhere in the world, because if you're sitting on a weed patch and there's lots of small dolphin around, there's a really good chance that somewhere in the area there could be a much larger predator. And having a 12-weight or having a 14-weight with a rod with a big fly on there, having a rod rigged with wire on it and a big fly, I've seen wahoo drift up in the big schools of dolphin. I've seen blue marlin come into schools of dolphin, white marlin, sailfish scooting around the edges, eating small dolphin. The difference can be between you standing there and saying, hey, I just saw one, look at him, he's really cool swimming by, or like, hey, grab me the other rod and let me see if I can put a fly in front of him. It could be the difference between the catch of a lifetime or watching it swim by. So it's really good when you're going offshore to be prepared. And having several weight rods and a rod with a big fly on there for a larger species, maybe one rig for wire. Wahoo are very uncommon, but I have seen them. But the things that will pop up more often than not would be any kind of billfish.
Interesting. That'd be a nice treat. Yeah, that'd make your day. What about
luck favors the prepared.
Yeah, what about other things like tuna and so forth? Are they in the same kind of area?
They are in the same kind of area. Fishing for tuna on fly is a lot different. Tuna are extremely fast moving. They don't really congregate around weeds. You'll find them feeding around weed lines, but they don't really congregate.
Okay.
Most of the time when I have tuna fits on fly, we're live chumming in an area where we know they're at, where we've seen bust or we've seen birds, making daisy chains of live bait, keeping them on so they run in 20, 30 feet out the back on a daisy chain with 15 or live baits or so and pulling handfuls of live bait in, and they kind of all school together until the tunas come up, getting them fired up on live baits and then throwing a fly into them. So, and they'll eat the same flies as the Dorado, but that's really a total different. You really have to be rigged up and ready to go and have live baits and be looking for tuna. It'd be more that you would be going looking for tuna and going to go tuna fishing, and you would run into dolphin rather than if you were, you know, dolphin fishing and running into tunas.
Okay, okay. Good to know. Anything else that you'd find out there would keep you busy while you're looking for dolphin?
A lot of times around the floating debris, you'll find triple tails, which are great to eat. They're beautiful and colorful. They're really cool. You can keep a 6 or a 7 weight rigged up with a small shrimp pattern or a little crab pattern. And you find a piece of wood or a sunken floating piece of tree or bamboo, it's not uncommon to have triple tails floating around it. So that's always good to have handy.
Okay. Let's take another quick break, and then we'll talk more about trip planning down to the Keys and coming to see you and doing some fishing. So we'll be right back. Have you ever dreamed about the classic actions of bamboo fly rods? Did you know that it's possible for you to make your own bamboo fly rods? With the help of Power Fibers online magazine, you can do just that. Power Fibers is a magazine dedicated to making bamboo fly rods and telling the stories about bamboo through the ages. From rod making techniques, stories about fishing bamboo rods, to rod maker profiles, to classic papers, Power Fibers has it all. Visit their website at www.powerfibers.com. That's www.powerfibers.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Tad Burke about Dorado on the Fly. If you'd like to ask Tad a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer it on the show tonight. Okay. So you said now is a good time. So what's the best seasons to be down there to fish for Dorado?
Anytime between May and July.
May to
August
July.
Can be good. September, they can come in September too. Any of your summer months. I always tell clients coming to do that type of fishing to get their tickets, pay a little extra for a refundable or exchangeable ticket. And if you get it, if your window is it's going to be blowing 25 and the weather's going to be bad, it's, you know, stay home.
Yeah, yeah. That's always an issue in the Keys, isn't it? You should plan for either a longer trip or change your ticket to make it work, because that can really knock you down. I know I've been down there even diving and been blown out a couple times. So, yeah. During the summer season, what other fish, let's say, offshore, it's kind of blowing hard, it's a little rough out there. Can we turn around and go the other direction and fish for some other fish if we're with you?
Absolutely. Our nearshore waters are great right now. The yellowtail fishing on the reef is really good in the summertime, and they're really good to eat. Mangrove snappers are spawning. They're also really good to eat, fun to catch. Our snook and redfish in the bay are very good. Permit fishing's good in the summertime, and there's always a chance of running into tarpon if that's what you're going to look for, or just areas where you could find a few. So there's always something to do.
Mm-hmm. What about bonefish in the summer?
Bone fishing can be very good in the summer as well.
Okay, okay. So lots of things to... If you're willing to be open about it, lots of things to go after besides what you're down there for, it sounds like, whether it's Dorado or whatever. And what people had asked about accommodations down there, if you're coming down, where's the best place to look for lodging and so forth?
Well, the Keys are 103 miles long.
Mm-hmm.
So it really all depends on which island you want to stay on or where you want to go. If you are staying in the Alamorada area, there's probably no less than 20 or 25 different places you can stay. You know, small mom-and-pop places that are clean and comfortable, and a place where you can take a hot shower and go to sleep and get up in the morning and go fishing, to, you know, large resorts that cater with spas and, you know, a little more a little more high end. So it really depends on your budget, what you're willing to spend, and where you want to stay. But if you Google lodging in Alamorada and Key Largo, there's just a bunch of places that you can pick to stay, kind of choose your own.
Yeah. Now, is Alamorada and Key Largo probably the best place to start out from to have access to the different types of water and so forth?
Alamorada is pretty centrally located as far as having access to Florida Bay and access to the offshore. So, yeah, the upper Keys have that to offer. The lower Keys as well. But, again, if you get blown out, it's good to have stuff in the backcountry. So Alamorada is a good place to start.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What city is the easiest and cheapest to fly into? Is that going to be Miami if you're going to stay in the Keys?
There's flights into Miami, Fort Lauderdale. There's flights into Key West, depending on where you're from. If you plan way ahead of time and you keep your, you keep your dates and options open, there's all kinds of deals you can put, you can set up for little things from TripAdvisor that'll let you know when there's a deal on a flight and if your schedule's flexible and you can go whenever the dates are, But there's direct flights, Florida and Fort Lauderdale, Miami and Fort Lauderdale are both pretty big hubs. So it's a pretty easy place to get to.
Okay. And anything particularly need to bring along if you're down there fishing for Dorado or just in general to the Keys where you recommend your clients if they're not familiar with fishing in salt water?
Just prepare to be flexible, good attitude. You can't – when you travel to fish, you have to realize that, it's not always going to be the perfect conditions for what you thought you were going to be able to go do. And – if you're willing to kind of expand and say, hey, Captain, what do you think would be the best thing for us to do? And you're willing to do that, you may have it may change your trip for you. Or if you just were focused on one thing and it wasn't going to happen and you decided to do something else, whatever your guide recommended, it might make the difference between you having a great trip down to the Keys and one that isn't so good. So it's good to be flexible. Anytime you travel anywhere to fish, it's good to be flexible.
Yeah, yeah. Now, are there any licenses required? When
the captains in the state of Florida have a blanket fishing license that covers our boats. So, no, if you're fishing with a licensed captain, you do not need a fishing license.
Okay. And maybe you can kind of combine the answer on this last question. Tim Barr in Illinois wrote in. He says, I would love to fish for Dorado. I'm a fisherman on a budget. Can you give me some ideas how to keep the cost down? So what is the range of guide services down there? And can you fish more than one person from the boat? And can you kind of address his budget questions?
That's really a tough one. Your bay boats, like the smaller boats, the boat I dolphin fish out of, which is really more on good days, if it's blowing 15 plus, it's not great to go out in, but, that's $700, $750 a day. Your big offshore sports fishing boats are upwards of $1,700 to $1,800 to $2,000 a day, plus fuel some of them, depending on how far they have to run. So it's kind of – that's just the standard across-the-board fee. I mean, that's the price of admission.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, it's not a cheap sport.
Yeah.
Our boats are expensive. Our saltwater equipment's expensive. Our insurance is expensive. It's just it's tough. It's tough on your equipment. It's tough on our boat.
When you're talking to, I think you said bay boat. You mean like a flats boat kind of?
No, we run small center consoles.
Oh, okay.
24 to 26 foot center consoles.
Can you fish two people out of a boat effectively?
Absolutely, absolutely. We carry two to three people, four people on the boat. If you're fly fishing, though, it's really only limited to, maybe someone in the stern throwing when we get to the school and someone in the bow throwing,
Okay.
It can be kind of limited. Everybody can't fish. If you're strictly going to fly fish and you're looking strictly to go look for Dorado,
mm-hmm.
You might have to wait your turn.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And those big boats you were talking about, the $1,700, are those more like group boats or party boats or that kind of thing?
Yeah, they carry up to six people. You can get the guys together and split a trip for sure.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of great captains down here. That's one thing that the Florida Keys has produced we're recruited all over the world to go work at fishing lodges and for outfitters and stuff. It's some of the best captains, best guides, best mates, they come out of South Florida and the Florida Keys.
Yeah. Well, I think I'm going to ask for closing remarks, but you've kind of, I think, already said it is, and maybe kind of reiterating what you said was coming down there with an open mind about fishing, and you'll have a better time. Is that a realistic closing statement for you?
Absolutely. You know, I've been guiding for going on 3 decades now, and, you know, it's really about being outside, seeing turtles, seeing man-of-war birds, seeing, you never know when you're going to see a National Geographic highlight moment.
Mm-hmm.
So if you come with the attitude that you're really going to see that catching the fish is the bonus and the trip is what you're coming for, the whole experience, you can really walk away with getting something. Like I say, you know, it's the price of admission. It's not about catching the fish. It's the price of admission. It's the boat ride. It's the waking up early. It's all of it. You know, it's about leaving the dock in the morning. So if you come with that attitude, you're going to have a good time.
Can you share with us a day on the water that didn't have anything to do with fishing that was really memorable for you?
Absolutely. I do a lot of free diving and snorkeling trips. And actually, my friend Megan, who called in, I had some very memorable days with her, taking her snorkeling and just seeing things and turtles and fish and just being on the water. I mean, the Keys is a beautiful place. So there's plenty of things to do for your family. Fishing can be a byproduct of going on the water and having a good day. It's not uncommon. I've done many times where I've taken a family, and in the morning we took the kids down and fed tarpon at a local marina and then taught them how to snorkel and then brought them to a reef where they could see a living coral reef and see fish, and then slipped offshore and caught them a dolphin on the way home in the afternoon. So there's all kinds of ways. There's all kinds of ways to make a day.
Yeah, sounds good. Well, let's wrap things up here, Ted. Stick with me for a few more minutes. We're going to give away a few prizes here and close things up. So when we return, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, a one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, and also be giving away a $25 gift certificate for Front Range Anglers. A mining company called Pac Rim Coal is planning a massive strip mine near Anchorage, Alaska. The Chewitna Coal Project would be the first project in Alaska history to mine directly through salmon habitat, the Chewitna River drainage. 11 miles of it, critical commercial, sport, and subsistence fishing economies would be permanently destroyed. Pac Rim says it can rebuild a salmon stream, but scientific experts can find no example where successful restoration has occurred after strip mining. Chewitna Coal will be shipped to Asia, leaving Alaska with nothing but devastated habitat and ruined salmon runs. It's time to stop the Chewitna Coal strip mine now. So for more information how you can help, visit www.inletkeeper.org. That's inletkeeper.org. Just a reminder to everyone, before you leave our website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section of tonight's show that said, "What did you think of this show?" Just click on the link. Leave your comments, and we'd really appreciate it. Well, now it's time to give away our prizes. The winners for our drawings tonight are randomly selected from the show's registration database, so if you didn't register for tonight's show, it's too late but make sure you do so for our next show so you don't miss out on a lot of these great prizes. If you are the lucky winner, we'll contact you after the show and provide you with information on how to receive your gift. So the first thing we're going to give away tonight is a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, a great organization. Whether you're freshwater, saltwater, warm water, they're good to go on all those things. If you want to learn more about the Federation, go to fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org. Okay, so let me fire up my selector here and see who our first winner is. Second. about that. Okay. We've got Len Hoskin in the United Kingdom. So we do have people listening all over the world. And Len in the UK, congratulations. We'll get you a membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, and thanks for listening. Another, we'll be giving away a one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal now, and that's through Amato Books. If you want to find out what Amato does, go to amatobooks.com. They have periodicals and books on fly fishing and all aspects of fly fishing, so check them out there. And our winner there is Douglas McLean in Alberta, Canada. So, again, thanks, Douglas, for listening and playing with us. We really appreciate it. All right. So let's give away this $25 gift certificate, and I need to come up with a question about tonight's show. And what make this easy on you guys tonight? What two things did Tad say he looks for when he's out trying to find Dorado? What two indicators did he look for to trying to find Dorado? And Treg says, current rifts, birds feeding, and debris. Would that be the right answer, Tad?
He's the man.
He's the man? Okay, Treg, you won again. Treg wins a lot. He's a devoted listener and a very knowledgeable fly fisher, from what I can tell. So, Treg, congratulations. Just send on over your information again, because I don't keep it on file. And you know the routine, and we'll get you that gift certificate. So thanks for playing. Thanks for listening carefully. And thanks to everybody else that was playing along with us, too. Tad, hey, we really appreciate you being on the show with us again. It's always a pleasure. Love to have you on, and I hope you enjoyed yourself.
Thanks, Roger. Always a pleasure, and you guys have a good evening.
Okay, great. Well, everybody, our next broadcast will be on July 16th, and it'll be 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And on that show, we're going to interview Michael Gorman. Our topic for the show will be effective stillwater fly fishing. Michael is a professional guide for more than 30 years, and he's going to help us to make the most of every stillwater fishing outing, even those ego-bruising days when the fish seem to reject everything. So join us to learn Michael's strategies, techniques, and secrets. We'd love to have you. We'd also like to thank Federation of Fly Fishers, Amato Books, the Front Range Anglers, Keeney's Fly Shop, and Power Fibers Online Magazine for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-800-985-1673, and we'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com, and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.